I would just say there's one misperception of our veterans, and that is they are somehow damaged goods. Although if we tell our veterans enough that this is what's wrong with them, then they actually start believing it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Dead Reckoning Radio. This episode we had Aaron Matthews. Aaron Matthews is a documentarian, and actually our first guest without any military ties. That was until his most recent documentary, The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien, which shows an intimate depiction of the journey Tim went through during his time of writing his most recent book, Dad's Maybe Book. We touched on a few topics with Aaron, which we thoroughly enjoyed. We hope you do the same.
Hey Aaron, how's it going?
Pretty good, Keith. How are you doing?
I'm good. We're really glad to have you on the show. This is, I think, the second non-veteran that we've ever had on, but it's definitely for a good reason. I'm really glad our paths crossed this last week. We were able to sit down and do this. So if you want to just tell everybody a little bit about what you do and where you're from, maybe how you grew up, and then we'll kind of take things forward from there.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. I'm honored to be among the crew here. So
absolutely.
Yeah. I've been looking forward to it. Let's see. Growing up, I grew up in Brooklyn, which is where I'm living now. And just connected to the mission of Dead Reckoning Collective. My earliest memory of like my dream job was wanting to be a writer, which is connected to why I wanted to make this film about Tim O'Brien.
Nice. Yep. So, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Gave that away. maybe before writer, it was a magician and Major League Baseball player. But,
nice.
Magician like Tim.
Exactly. Yeah.
I did not know that about him.
Yeah. That's a surprise about him. You know, he's got some unexpected hobbies.
I love that he's
really good at magic too, you know?
Oh man, yeah. So everybody knows, Tyler and I have seen what is the documentary of Tim O'Brien that Aaron's been working on, and it's absolutely incredible. Some of the shots of him doing magic, I was just like blown away. And then the quote from his wife that like magic was not a part of my life before I met Tim, like cracked me up, because I could relate it to so many things other than magic in a marriage.
Like, yep.
So many things become a part of your life, like with anyone, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Thanks for pointing that out. That is one of the aspects of the film that I was drawn to, and that I liked as I was putting it together, that it's not just this portrait of a writer, but you really get a sense of a family, and the struggles that come with having, you know, young kids and someone at the center who's, you know, struggling with the past and struggling with trying to make something, you know, which mm-hmm. all of us are at some level, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
We'll go back to you though. So you said you grew up in Brooklyn, and you said Brooklyn. When your
magic didn't work out.
Magic didn't work out.
Magic and baseball,
not in the cards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
good one.
Did you write from a young age? Because you were saying like writing was kind of a goal from when you were younger too.
I got really into writing in like junior high school and high school. And I think I was initially drawn to like the beat writers, you know. They seemed like they were the kind of writers that particularly like young boys are drawn to, you know. And they were, a lot of them, like Jack Kerouac and Ken Kesey, they were not just really good writers and interested in capturing like experience, but they were also good athletes, which appealed to me at the time. Mm-hmm. Jack Kerouac played football, and Ken Kesey was like a wrestling star. And so I was kind of like drawn to the image of those guys. And
well, they weren't only just writing, but they're actually kind of living what they're writing about too. And so
exactly. Yeah. And that was kind of one of the seeds that later kind of, I guess, turned into like documentary film, because I ended up being drawn to then like the new journalists, you know, like Truman Capote and Joan Didion and Clinton, and people who, like you were saying, Tyler, people who kind of lived the stories they were telling. And so I had this idea that I would write those kinds of books. And at some point I just realized that writing was too solitary an activity for me. You know, I just couldn't deal with the solitude. Like to be a really good writer, you needed to spend so much time alone.
Yeah.
And documentary film seemed like a way to merge like the, you know, the desire to go out into the world, to see the world, to meet new people, to have adventures and go places that I wouldn't have under normal circumstances, but also then to kind of shape it into a story. You know,
yeah.
So is that something you started exploring like when you were that young too, or
like when I was in junior high and high school?
Yeah, like filmmaking, like
no. I went to college and kind of almost like from the moment I got into college, I couldn't wait to get out. I was already feeling like I was sick of school. So I wanted to figure out a way to kind of live this life we were talking about, where I could like work part time and also see the world and travel. And so I taught English as a second language in Spain. I ended up moving back to New York, teaching here, working in cable television, because I started thinking like, oh, maybe I should work in documentary film around sometime in my 20s. And I made a short film about a local barber in my neighborhood, this old Italian barber who was a ex-boxer and tango dancer. I made it on actual film, and it was like super expensive to make, meaning it costs like, you know, it was like $2,000 just for an hour of footage, which that's how much like real film cost at the time to like take it and develop it. So I shot an hour of footage. I made a 10-minute film, and it did pretty well as a short film. Like, you know, it got into some festivals and good enough so that I kind of convinced myself like, oh, I can do this thing.
Yeah.
That was like the curse, you know, like the tiny bit of success I got with that little short film made me think like, you know, oh, I can make documentary films. And
that's what you need.
Yeah.
I guess a little bit of validation to,
yeah,
to push you a little further.
And that was right after college, pretty much, while you're working.
So I kind of was working part time and traveling throughout my 20s, and I made Tato, this short film about the barber, when I was 25.
Okay.
Wow.
And just kept getting after it after that, like film after film, or did you take some break, or like when you realized you finished that, when you're like, this is what I'm going to do, and kind of hit the ground running?
Yeah, I started. I knew that I wanted to make my own films, but it's just really hard. I mean, it's almost impossible unless you're independently wealthy or you have a patron or to just make the films you want to make. So since that time, I've just been working other jobs. Like, and now I'm pretty much regularly, at least before this all happened, you know, the new world we're living in, working as an editor and director, producer for hire for other people's films. And then, you know, save up money and take time off when I can, nights and weekends, try to make my own projects.
Cool.
So, yeah. Awesome. I don't think I answered your growing up question, but that I just started to answer that and thought like,
man,
that.
It all sounds
so
like
boring, and like, so I'm not going to put you to sleep too early.
No, it all sounds like a lot of grown up to me.
Yeah.
And then you also worked on The Draft, which I just watched. Yeah. I tried to like really catch up because obviously everybody knows Ken Burns, but the films that you've made, that you recommended that I watched before we talk, were incredible. The Draft was really, really good. So if
thank
anybody
you,
has, it's
saying,
that's a PBS, right?
Yeah, it was PBS. They hired me to direct that film and put together a story of the history of the American military draft. And it was, it was eye opening for me on so many levels. And it led to the film on Tim.
So how did the hire for that happen then?
Yeah.
Cause you said they hired you, like,
right. So I was working for a production company called Partisan Pictures, and they were actually hired to do it. And okay. I was hired by Partisan to, I had awesome. Worked on a few of their projects, and they hired me to work on that. So yeah.
Awesome.
So they picked cool. you for the draft. Cause that's what I was going to kind of ask was, did you have this fascination with the military at that point, or did you kind of just stumble into that and you're like, oh, this is really interesting. And then you kind of got more into it.
I really, I didn't have a fascination with the military at all. They just asked me if I wanted to work on it. And it just so happens that my wife, Jennifer Mittelstadt, who's actually in the film, she's kind of the star of the draft.
Yeah.
She had just written a book about the military. And she knew a lot about this thing. And I, should have paid more attention to what she was doing. But she gave me a quick primer on it all. And then she ended up like really helping me learn a lot about it and helping shape that film. And the subject matter for me was just really eye opening. And my big takeaway was that, the military is this huge, important institution in the United States, and we don't really pay as much attention to it as we should be.
It's one of those things that people always say, people should have to do that, and I'm like, no, they shouldn't. It doesn't really work that way. And there are countries that are proof of that, where conscription is a part of growing up, and it doesn't always go very well, right?
Right.
I think a PBS documentary like yours is very important for, for Americans to see, to kind of remind them of that. Cause a lot of people don't remember those times.
Right.
We haven't had a draft, thankfully, like in our lifetime. So,
Yeah. And I guess the other thing that just struck me though, like there are like, for me, there was like these costs and benefits of not having a draft. Right. It's like the cost seems like Americans don't feel so implicated in the wars we wage and so few people are a part of it. It's like 0.5%, right? So and that seems like a cost, where like the military is doing this job, carrying all the burden of the killing and the dying and other services that they perform, and everyone else can kind of feel like that they're that they support the military, but they don't really have to do that work, and I don't know, I thought that just like struck me as like not a little unfair, and also like for like the idea of citizenship and what it means to be an American. I think it kind of colors that,
Yeah. It's definitely, it's something to think.
Divide, of.
Yeah. No, and that was kind of what I was thinking as I was watching that too, is that, it's very interesting that yes, they did away with the draft, but recruiting has just kind of shifted into the same thing. Right. And like points were made like very well, about that as well. Like in the movie, in terms of like, the shift from the draft being eliminated, it kind of made the military like a, this heroic role again, right? Whereas, people were kind of viewing it like with their noses up to it almost, when the draft was around. There was a lot more like the military seemed a lot more virtuous after the draft was eliminated. So, I don't know. It was, I thought the way that the documentary went from, the very, very beginnings of conscription in the United States to, you know, what the elimination of the draft did was really cool. But
yeah, and it's history a lot of people don't know also, you know.
No. And I always look for that in a documentary. So, like, if anybody else is you know, into nerding out like I am, it's definitely something that I think a lot of people that follow us will be interested in learning about. But it's definitely a good documentary, even for those that haven't actually experienced that much of anything like that. So,
well, you're going to get like number one fans. I've watched two of the documentaries that I've made.
I know, man. I'm a fanboy now. Like, the resume's stacked as far as I'm concerned. So,
so you actually directed the draft as well?
Yep.
And so I kind of want to get more into that, like actually the filmmaking process. And so I know the Tim O'Brien one is roughly an hour and a half long of the final, roughly the final product. How long was the draft? I haven't watched it just yet. And then with that question, how long did it actually take you to make? Because I know the Tim O'Brien one, filming happened for at least over a year, year and a half, probably even longer. And so, like, how much time are you willing to dedicate to one project like that to kind of give some insight to somebody who may be interested in doing something like that?
I can answer the first question because I'm the super fan now. I think it was like an hour and 47 minutes. But Be warned, on Amazon, it'll tell you that it's a series, and I was really pissed off when it ended and there wasn't a next episode.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah, it's listed on there as a series. I was pretty livid because I finished that one and I was like, cool, what's next? Like, and then there was, but I was like, what else is there? Like,
where do you go from here?
I don't know how much more there can be about a draft. How many episodes is this? And sure enough, nothing.
At least you didn't expect the film about the NBA draft, which is what most people are like, wait a minute. Oh, you didn't do this about the football?
Yeah, it's called SportsCenter. Right.
That's what most people wish the film was about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, with the draft for PBS, working for this production company, we had a whole team and it was paid for in advance. So just in terms of the nuts and bolts differences between the two projects, with the draft, yeah, I had a support crew. We had a schedule. So that film took, I think, from start to finish, like 4 months to make, which was pretty accelerated. I think most films benefit from being able to kind of, and I'm sure this is true with books and poems, and, you know, they benefit from being able to take some time off away from it and then go back, look at what you've done, make corrections and fix things that you didn't notice when you had your head down into it, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, so because the draft was basically a fully funded project, there was like no stopping, and we could go, pretty quickly. And we had a lot of people working on it. With the Tim O'Brien film, I was basically doing that film. It took me 4 years to make, and I was working other jobs in the meantime because I couldn't afford to hire basically anyone. On a handful of shoots, I would hire and ask director of photography friends to help me film. But mostly it was just like me showing up at the airport with my film bags, getting on a plane to Austin and hanging out and embedding with Tim and his very generous, open family who put up with me.
So that's where he lives in Austin?
Yeah, he lives in Austin.
Okay, so I saw he went to the Texas Med Clinic, and I'm like, wait, is that when he's on the road, or I'm just going?
Yeah.
I'm originally from Austin, so that, like, some of it looked, it kind of looked familiar at some parts, and I'm like, it looks, and I just didn't really connect the dots.
He's gonna go try and find him now.
Yeah, and I'm gonna go try to stalk it, find out that street, see if there's any street addresses or anything in there.
That's the thing.
Or I guess I can just ask you.
That'll come at a price.
Yeah.
That's how I'll fund post-production for this film.
Yeah. Perfect.
But yeah, when you're doing the film independently. I did get a couple grants for the War and Peace of Tim O'Brien, but they were pretty small and didn't begin to cover. It's mostly like the time, my time. And then like finishing the film costs money. Like even if you have friends in the industry, like, you know, can the sound mix the film, to color correct the film, to do all the things that make it look like a film at the end, like just those rooms, sitting in those rooms cost a lot of money. So
yeah.
Well, and it was probably like filming wise, like it was probably a lot different for you from the draft too, because like the film with Tim is all, it seems like aside from like a couple older shots, it's pretty much all original footage, right? Like, whereas the draft is a lot of archive footage and a lot of, you know, individual interviews. So,
totally.
So that was probably a lot different in the process as well, right?
Definitely. And like, I guess like if you were to characterize the styles of the films, like film terms, like they would say, the draft is more like a talking heads documentary where there's like experts and then information and a voiceover kind of telling you information and sometimes how you should think or interpret a scene. And then like the Tim O'Brien film, like they call it like a verite film, which is like a kind of bad fancy sounding word that just means like real, like you said, like live action footage filmed in the moment. And what I would do is just kind of, you know, hang around Tim and his family and follow them wherever they were going with the camera. And then you kind of put that story together more in the edit room, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So like the script is kind of done after in a way, like you go in with a plan, but but then you kind of rip up that plan.
a buddy of mine filmed a documentary about my fire department about a year and a half ago, and that just reminded me of that because he had this very vague idea. He's like, I want to make a documentary about the history of our fire department, and then he did kind of, I guess, like a talking head kind of live action one in a way, but mostly talking head. And at the end of it, I was like, well, if you could have done anything different, he's like, I wish I had a script beforehand because trying to tell a story after the fact, he's like, I had to rewatch everything like dozens of times just to try to figure out where everything needed to go. But to hear you say pretty much the same thing, that the script is kind of comes after, I guess there's just no way around it.
There really isn't. There's this quote from Eisenhower that I always remember that's totally appropriate for a documentary film, which is, he says, the plan is nothing, planning is everything. And that's like, for me, what that means is like you make the plan, you go in there, it's totally upended, and you know all your expectations are turned over. But if you haven't planned, if you haven't done the planning, like you're totally lost.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So in the end, like the plan really is nothing, but it's all in the planning, you know.
And yeah.
And making that plan that you know is going to be destroyed, you know. So it's like a balance between, you know, like really dispiriting and then really, you know, exhilarating.
Oh, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, because like, I mean, it must be worked the same with you as, you know, a lot of our projects and stuff too. Like sometimes something will look really good to you and then somebody else will lay eyes on it and say, well, like, not really, you know? So.
All the time.
It's like, no, that's never happened. Mine's great.
Yeah, right.
I don't know what you mean. Yeah.
My inner voice, but then, yeah, it happens plenty with other people too. You know, you just like that crushing realization, like, oh yeah, this just is not working. What do you guys, I'm curious, like what kind of stuff you work on and what like personally, like what kind of pros you do?
So Tyler and I co-authored Fact and Memory, which is a book of poetry. And we kind of did that early on in the process to like fine tune our publishing process. We just wanted to, you know, we already kind of had plans in place, but we wanted to make sure that if we were going to screw up somebody's work, it was our own instead of you know, clients as a publishing company. So, but yeah, now we're working with a number of poets and authors, as well as we're doing the second volume of this larger poetry anthology of post 9/11 veterans. Mm-hmm. And this will be going to a different charity than the first one. So yeah, we just keep busy with all these written projects and stuff, but it's pretty cool to see, you know, guys, especially like I was telling you, you know, like Tim, influence the next generations. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we're going to be some of the names that people recognize, you know, in generations to come. Cause as long as there's, you know, the human race, there's always going to be war. But I mean, there's a good chance, cause I've been reading, this book called Winning Hearts and Minds. It's an independently, do you know it? Cause it was actually originally published in Brooklyn.
You know, that rings a bell, and then Hearts and Minds, you know, is that Michael Hare, right?
No, it's documentary. It's a bunch of, you're right. Yeah. So this is, it's Vietnam veterans, and they were basically doing, and I found out about it after we had released the first one, but they had done a compilation of poetry of all Vietnam veterans and stuff, and they donated all the money, kind of similar to what we're doing, to like wartime relief in Indochina, because they felt so strongly about what they had done, right? And so I've been trying to get a hold of those guys for a little bit, but I mean, again, you know, like I said, like, I don't know if we'll be the names that people study, or if anybody we work with will.
So that's always kind of been, yeah, that's always kind of been the goal. Is we started off as like, kind of like a blog, and essentially like years ago of us just writing articles, kind of highlighting other people and telling like the successful veteran transition stories, because there'd been kind of a stigma attached to these veterans. And then we realized we really liked writing, but we also liked helping other people share stories, and also just getting the kind of the unknowns known kind of within this community. And so then, like you said, we put out Fact of Memory, and now we're trying to help other people. But where the kind of the conflict is Keith and I both like to create ourselves, yet we're also trying to run the business at the same time. So we have to kind of manage both of those, but for the most part, write articles, poems. I've been working on a book for over 3 years now, so I'm trying to finish that. And then Keith's working on a book as well. And then any other kind of creative outlet that we can kind of come up with. I do woodworking occasionally. I do house projects occasionally. I know it's not art or creating. I guess it kind of is.
It is. It really is, man.
But But for the most part, we've created this network to kind of just get people's stories out there and help others share theirs. And like you said, even if Keith Down, Tyler Carroll aren't the names, maybe we put people onto the names of people who are going to be studied later on.
Yeah.
That's great. I think it's a really great project. I think we need poets and writers to tell us the human cost of war, you know, because stats and numbers only go so far. And in a way, they're just kind of incomprehensible
to
most people. Like, it just doesn't mean anything after a while. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Even like the tallies now with coronavirus, it's just like it starts to just be so abstract, you know?
Yeah, it's hard to understand those numbers, because they're there, but everything's layered. You don't know if that person had whatever health conditions or it's hard to comprehend any of it. But I don't know if it was Keith and I talking about it recently or what, but we don't want, because Keith and I were just enlisted soldiers. Keith made an NCO, E5. I never did. I was a medic. He's an MP. Neither one of us were these big, badass special operation dudes or anything. But we still felt like we did something worthy. And then at the same time, we don't want the generals and these big wigs telling the story of our war. We want the frontline guys.
I think it was Marty that was saying it.
Yeah, is that who we were just talking to about it?
Yeah, Marty made a really good point about how, you know, the the lower guys need to be telling their own stories, because otherwise the only books that are going to come out are, you know, either these very high profile special operations guys who only tell a very important part of the story, but it's only a part of the story, you know. And the same with the general's perspective, where, you know, the average guys need a voice as well. So yeah. I think we have we've been blessed with a very like even blend of people from all different walks of mm-hmm. the military and all different walks of life, you know, that are following us and that we have the pleasure of communicating with on a regular basis. So it's definitely been a cool project. But
yeah, because you know those bigwigs are going to they have more of an opportunity to be able to tell their stories. You know,
oh yeah.
It's like with anything. If you have the money and the power, you'll get your story out there.
Yeah,
they've almost been institutionalized in some sense too. If they've been in that long now,
yeah,
that's not always the case, and maybe they still remember where they came from prior to the military. But I only did 4 years, so I knew who I was before and who I am after, and that changed me and everything. But it didn't necessarily create me or make a whole living off of it. So it was just kind of a part of my life.
Yeah. You got that medical training, which is like, especially in a time like this, I just feel like...
Oh, it was fun. I had a good time.
Yeah, and plus you have like a useful skill, man, like a really useful skill. Yeah. It's yeah. You know, in addition to be able to build a fence, which is pretty useful.
But well, that comes from high school. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So do you feel like with your, you know, your recent films, like with The Draft, and what is the actual title? Because I keep just saying the movie with Tim.
Oh, The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien.
War and Peace. So
see, that came from reading a book, actually. I was reading The War and Peace.
Good for you, man.
Around when
it took congrats.
More than a whole summer. But like halfway through it, like I had just met Tim and I was like, man, this is a pretty great title, actually. And
oh, yeah.
Like, I'd like to use this title because it pretty much it's very simple and it kind of says exactly what I want to say about like Tim and his life now.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was just like, all right, maybe I'll just add of Tim O'Brien there. And it was like a working title that everyone seemed to like, or at
I
least
like
not
it.
Somebody hated.
Oh no,
it.
It tells the story perfectly. By the end of it, yeah.
So, with the two films that you just recently did, do you feel like that's kind of like lit a spark for you in terms of like, you know, the direction that you would like to go with filmmaking? Like, I know a lot. Like you said that, you know, you have to do jobs that also pay bills.
Yeah.
But do you feel like, in terms of like where your passion is at, do you think you would want to do more films, you know, relating to the military and veterans and stuff like that?
I definitely wouldn't turn it down. I've learned an awful lot about the military and war, and like I've been so steeped in it just with this other my paid work doing, you know, the documentaries for the Medal of Honor game.
Right.
I've been so steeped in war. I actually feel like I need a break from it. Because it's been like 5 or 6 years of just like wall-to-wall war. And then one of the appeals for me of documentary has always been that like I get to become a very, very semi-expert in one thing. Mm. And then like forget about it and do something kind of different, you know?
Yeah.
So... I mean, I'm sure I will, just because I'm so interested in the military now, like do other war related and veteran related projects. But I don't have anything like on tap right now, because my main job now is getting this film out there and
right.
hoping people can see it. So, which is like a whole other part of the process that, like, you know, especially these days, it's even harder, I think, than when I started, like 20, 25 years ago, because it's so crowded out there. That
you kind of want to. Sorry, to interrupt. I thought you were finishing.
No.
But, do you want to kind of go over like the outline that you said that you originally had, like that plan of The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien? Because you had this idea before you really even met him, and And then how did it actually play out to your like expectations?
Yeah, it's it changed so many times, you know, that I can't even. I have like 250 pages of notes that I could like go through and really bore you if I like read what my first thought was in like December 2015 about the film. Every time I like had a different thought or idea, I would write it down. I know like initially I was really interested, like I tend to be drawn by the big social issue, and in this it was war and the meaning and impact of war. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk about kind of a continuation of what I had learned about in the draft. And I thought Tim's story about going to war, kicking and screaming, basically, but then surviving and struggling and coming to terms with it was a really interesting way to tell the story of the draft, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so that's where it started, and then it evolved so many times and so many different ways. I can't even be like, basically every time I had a shoot with him though, I had a plan. Like, I'm gonna shoot this, you know. Yeah. we're gonna do this. He's gonna teach, he's gonna go shopping, he's going to meet with a veteran in his writing class, and he's going to, you know, take his blood pressure or whatever. And then, like, I get there, and like, it would be totally different, or that person wouldn't show up, or you know, yeah. he got sick. You know, when I'm giving away a major plot point in the film now, but you know, he gets really sick, and I had no, you know, that obviously, like that. I would have never gone there if I had known he was that sick.
Well, no, it was. It shows the struggles of him, like that writer's toil of like wanting to finish this project and like how much has been wearing on him that he almost became physically ill from it, and he was still, he was like hallucinating, still,
yeah.
trying to process what he's been trying to process this entire time. So like it was captivating. So.
Yeah,
you captured a good shot.
The amount that Tim smokes in that movie, like, actually, literally puts me into a place, like a point in my life where I was like, I don't even like smoking anymore. I want to stop, but I can't. But like, I was hanging out. It was when I was stationed at Fort Lewis, and I was hanging out at this like bar that, like, obviously public, you know, public like restaurants and bars and stuff you couldn't smoke in. But the upstairs of this bar was a private club. So they charged like a $10 a year membership and you could smoke in there. And I was like, this is disgusting. Like, this is the worst. But like, I was still smoking. Like, I couldn't. And it put me right back there, like the amount that he smokes in them. I don't think there's very many moments other than when he's with his kids, I think, like, is the only time he's really not smoking, which also says something about him. You know?
Yeah. That was, well, maybe that's a public service aspect of the film that people will not want to smoke after.
I don't know. I think he's pretty cool, so I might take it back up.
Yeah, but that contradiction you just mentioned was another one of the motivations of what drew me to making the film. Mm-hmm. You know, he was like the soldier who hated war. He's like a super sensitive, thoughtful individual who's like also tough as nails and just like,
yeah.
you know, he's just like he does not, you know, take any guff, you know.
Yeah.
A smoker who wrestled with his own mortality, you know, and plus he's a magician and all those things were like, yeah, they were interesting character.
It was super cool to, when you're talking about, like, you just see how he is with his kids and his wife, and just like, you don't really see him get angry like within his family life. I don't know if it just seems like he's just really mellow when he's at home. He seems happy, at least.
Yeah.
And then, but when he gets talking about the war, you see like it get going, and that tough as nail part of him comes out, like whenever he was with the other Vietnam vets and they're kind of arguing back and forth, and he was just giving him his peace of mind. I was like,
yeah,
this dude's passionate.
Right.
I think he gets, you see that in the draft too, where, you know, he, he was speaking as like a correspondent on, I can't remember what news network it was. Doesn't really matter. He gets that same way when he's talking about sending, you know, the future generations mm-hmm. off to war. And he talks about, you know, the dead bodies, and he talks about doing these terrible things as a very young man, and how people seem to forget that. Right. And I can't remember if it was him in that documentary too, but when I think it was when he was saying that, like, you know, we should replace the word war in the dictionary with killing people, mm-hmm, because yeah. when it's the singular word, people can make it whatever they want it to be.
It's abstract,
as opposed to, but yeah, no, we're just going through the whole documentary. Nobody's even going to want to watch it now.
Oh no, they're going
to
want to watch it.
It's cool to see too. You can just watch it muted and remember everything that we said, but. was it difficult working with Tim at all? I mean, other than, you know, his health and stuff like that, was he immediately open to the idea of the movie, or?
He was initially reluctant. Like I wrote him, right after the interview with him. Because basically the interview I did with him for the draft, I felt like I had just like gotten my heart blown open. You know, the interview with him about war and the meaning of war was like none I had. It was really like no interview I'd ever done, with the exception of maybe a couple, you know, other interviews with people, in terms of them being on par with like the emotional intensity, the intelligence, and just the overall, you know, engagement with the issues. And and I never knew, like, it was the kind of interview where I felt like I never knew whether he was gonna like crack me up or make me cry, you know. He has that effect where he's like he's got like a lot of grief in his face, but he's also got like the comedian sparkle, yeah, you know, his eye. Just to go back to your question, he was reluctant also, I think, from a storyteller perspective. He just kept saying, you know, I don't know how you're going to make a film about me. All I do is sit in my underwear and write, you know, not a good story, which like was obviously really dispiriting for me, you know, like, shit, how am I going to tell? It was like underscored like that I was telling a story about a master storyteller, and like the fucking pressure.
This is a terrible idea.
Yeah, terrible idea.
Yeah.
So I ended up like using some mileage, got on a plane like 3 or 4 months later, and just stayed with a friend in Austin, and we talked about the possibility of doing the film. And he warmed up to the idea. And then like next month I went back and I made like 3 visits a year to his house, and then filmed him on the road. And so it ends up being like a really kind of pretty personal, intimate, you know.
Oh, it's very personal.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you see a side to him that like a lot of people haven't seen, you know. They know the public Tim. But,
yeah. Well, it's always cool seeing, yeah, the behind the scenes of people who you admire, especially somebody who, like you said, is so intelligent, so emotional, because when you read his books, it's displayed right there in front of you.
Yeah. What always interested me about him was that, like, he could be, like, your next-door neighbor or the guy who, like, gives you your beer at the bar, except, like, he's clearly operating at another level, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he just, like... His words are like his writing, you know, there's nothing, there's no like, you know, big $2 words in there or many syllable. They're somehow like very simple, spare words that capture feelings and emotion and like events in a new, fresh way. And you're just like, how did he do that? You know, how's it? And that's what it was like being with him. You know, he's like a regular guy who's like not a regular guy, yeah, you know.
So. Had you already read most of his books or some of his books before meeting him? Had you read any of his books?
This will be my first confession.
Oh, shit.
It'll just be.
He's made a funny face too.
Yeah. Even before I interviewed him for the draft, I basically just skimmed the things they carried. I read On the Rainy River, which has to do with the draft.
Yeah.
But I really hadn't read his. I was not a fan of Tim O'Brien just because I hadn't read his stuff really.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met Tim, and I wanted to do the film just based on meeting him, on his personality. Mm. And then once I decided to do the film, I was like, oh shit, now I gotta read his books. And I hope to hell I like them, because I really like this guy. And like, if I don't like his writing, that's going to be awkward, and maybe I shouldn't do the film. But thankfully, I ended up reading all his books, and I really, I love his writing, and especially the first book I read, actually, even before The Things They Carried, was In the Lake of the Woods, and I thought that was amazing. And then Going After Cacciato, so that's just like a far out trippy war story, and peace story in a way too.
I really like his off war ones, like In the Lake of the Woods and I think July
by Tomcat. Funny Nuclear Age, also really funny.
Yeah. Just really cool, like, to see him do other things, and I'm sure that's, you know, what he wanted to do.
That's cool. In the film.
I was wondering.
All right, so you asked the most uncomfortable question, and you put
but it makes sense. And I mean, you're not old as fuck yet, Aaron, but like you're older than Tyler and I. So, for me, The Things They Carried was actually required reading in high school. I know I've talked to other people, and it hasn't been.
It wasn't like, for me.
I don't think that's a national thing.
It's pretty close to national now that I've doing this film opened my eyes to like, whoa, this like every young person I meet knows this guy and this book, because it's like their introduction to what war is, really. Like,
And I think that's the thing too. What's really cool about Tim, dare I say Tim and us, is that we will post things, you know, about The Things They Carried. We'll post things about Tim O'Brien, you know, a quote from an interview or something. Because he has, you know, aside from his writing, he has an amazing way of articulating verbally how to tell a story and what the benefits of telling stories are, and you know, in all other things about war and stuff. But it's really cool when we post things like that, and people who don't read very much and don't write anything at all will immediately relate to it, because they've read that in high school, and then they experience some of the things that he talked about, you know, later on in life, like when they, you know, experience, you know, similar things to what he was talking about in his books. And I think that is one of the coolest things that we've experienced, you know, as a company, is that, you know, we have this social media platform and stuff, and we can, you know, kind of promote something like that, and immediately, like, we'll get a reaction out of someone, because even though they're not a reader per se, they probably had to read a little bit of that for high school. And so that'll ring a bell, or, you know, but yeah,
that is one of the things that I think it's heartbreaking for Tim, but it's also like, uplifting or whatever, you know, encouraging for him, that people will come up to him after readings and say, The Things They Carried, that's the only book I've ever read, you know. and he's like, he doesn't know how to react to that. He's like, okay, on one hand, I think like he's honored. On the other hand, he's like, god damn, man, read another book. <You know? laughs> Please.
It's one of my top. But what's funny, just kind of put in perspective, like, kind of like how cool this is for Keith and I, is like maybe 6 months ago, he sent me a picture of Dad's Maybe book, and he's like, hey man, Tim just released this new book, and he's like, you gotta check it out. He's like, this is totally different than anything else I've read. And then less than a week ago, we came across you. So, and then the whole film is about that process of that book. So like, it It's cool when you get to kind of nerd out with people who like the same things as you, is really what it is. So it's cool.
Same here. Totally. Yeah, this book was really the Dad's Menu book. It was really interesting to follow him writing it, just as someone who also makes stories. You like to see someone who's like so got so many insights, and he's so articulate about what makes a good story. To watch him, you know, in the process, and also just like, I love a lot of the writing in the book. I mean, it's really powerful, and I think it works in the film too. You know,
yeah, it really does.
Did you kind of try? Was he writing the book when you met him?
He had written a couple things, a couple elements of the book. He had already written, like, the opening chapter was actually an article in Time. By the time I met him, he had over like 15 years, he had written about 150 pages. Mm-hmm. So he said, like, it's been a pitiful output. You know, he would say, like, John Updike would be, you know, would look askance at that, you know, it's like, just be ashamed of my output, you know. but because he was like really prolific, Updike, you know. But Tim stopped writing because, you know, largely because he had a family. And I went into it thinking he wasn't going to finish it, actually. And a lot of times, as you can see in the film, like, it seems like he's not going to finish it. And
yeah,
and he kind of wants to give up and throw his typewriter computer out the window, whatever. Yeah.
He kind of has an old computer too, still. What the heck?
Yeah. It's old. Yeah. Yeah.
I've never, I've scoured, you know, interviews, like, when I kind of obsess about someone, like, and I really admire them, I try to find, you know, everything I can, just to learn more. Right. So I've listened to pretty much any podcast episode that, that anybody's put out, any video interview that's on YouTube. Like, I've tried to watch at least once. I just think it's super interesting to gain some insight into somebody like that. And, oh, yeah. I didn't know, unless I missed it, I didn't know that he had, you know, put writing away for his family, which I thought was pretty incredible, because that's, you know, that largely became who he was apart from the war.
That's it. Yeah. And he talks about that. Like, it defined who he was. And I think he was really resistant to having kids also.
That was a really interesting part too, but not overly surprising. I know a lot of people, you know, feel the same way.
Sure. It's mixed. I mean, I feel that way about my own kids. It's not just although they're making so much noise right now, just that I was never like 100% going into having my kids thinking like, this is what I want to do. Like, have kids. For, I was never felt like 100% convinced. I knew I wanted kids, but then there was always like another side of me thinking, is this the right decision? Or I don't know. I feel like if you're not kind of, you know, having those doubts, you're not really thinking about it fully.
Yeah. There's a lot that goes into it.
Everything is such a shocker and so unexpected about, you know, kids, and such a life changer, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it definitely, like, the film did a really good job of capturing the lesser known parts, I guess, of him and his life, you know?
Yeah.
Like, back to the Dad's Maybe book, like, did you try to base the film? Because there's a lot of excerpts from the book, like, in the audio and stuff. Like, did you kind of try to base the film around the chapters of the book, or what you liked from the book? Or did he have a role in kind of picking some of those parts?
He didn't have any say in terms of like what was going to go in. I did show him the film and excerpts at times just to see what he thought. But I was really fortunate to have him, you know, in my corner and as a collaborator, because he's basically let me make the film that I wanted to make. But I knew, because his writing was so good and like you said, his words are able to, you know, capture things and emotions that that people often have trouble expressing, and yet they're very accessible. I thought they would work well in film and with images. And so the initial cut of the film, I was using parts of the things they carried that I liked, because he hadn't written Dad's Maybe Book yet.
Yeah.
But once he started writing it and reading it to me, I was like, oh man, this should be, they should function almost as like chapters in the documentary, where like they kind of track his progress. You know, he's writing the book and here's a little excerpt, and you know, I built those like collages, those like especially like the you know, the war footage from Vietnam is very kind of, you know, it's supposed to have like a saturated, like almost dreamy feel, and his writing is transportative in that way, and a lot of his writing about the war feels almost like, I mean, his line in the film is like it's happening, but it's I'm already mangling the you can't write to him, you can't recite to him, right? Everything is happening, but it's not happening. Something like that.
Yep.
So I knew I wanted to have his writing in the film.
Yeah.
But I just wasn't sure what it was going to take, I guess, is the short answer.
Yeah. Well, I think it was put in there very well. Like the transitions, it seemed like it was spaced out very evenly.
Yeah.
But it was, each excerpt was there with a purpose, you know?
Yeah, that was thank you. Yeah. The idea was that it, you don't just get a flavor of like his process, but also it's kind of advancing the story a little bit too, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for noticing that.
Well, I'm a super fan now, so, you know.
You got to get another film under your belt, though.
Yeah.
Then
you're going to have to make one.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is where do you go from here now? We'll talk about the release date here in a bit, but now that you finished this and you're going to be promoting this for probably quite a while, are you working on new projects, or do you got new projects in mind that you're going to be, or is that sensitive, top secret information type thing?
It's definitely not top secret. I just, friend of mine says that he's a monogamous filmmaker, meaning that like he sticks with the film until it's finished, you know? And like, I can identify with that, because it's hard for me to think about starting another film until I get, you know, The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien out, and it's like found its wings and it's flying and it's okay on its own. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just want to make sure that happens. So that's like where all my mental energy is going now. And I don't know.
I'm sorry. So it's PBS too, right?
No, no one actually. I don't have a distributor for it yet. So
we'll see.
So what happens now? Because you had to cancel the initial screenings and stuff, and like the actual release of it.
Right. The premiere was canceled. Now it looks like a lot of these festivals are doing online versions. So.
Yeah.
And
I guess you can always just watch a movie on your computer, so you just don't get to mingle around.
Right. So the festivals are Zoom. Yeah, they're kind of built for the mingling part, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, like you said, it's also just made for the kind of world we're in now, where everyone can watch a movie online. So I find it difficult to concentrate on anything these days. Yeah. You know? Just with the news being so grim.
I'll just avoid it right now.
Yeah, I think that's the best approach, man.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of like little ideas that are not fully formed. Yep. But I'm not being coy. I'm just like, yeah, I just don't have anything for you. Sorry.
No, that's fine. I think that's a good idea to just you stick on one project till you see it through. I'm not good at that within house projects or other projects. I need that kind of focus.
Oh yeah,
that's a good thing.
Well, we'll definitely keep up with you in terms of like the film and the release and whatever, you know, screenings are available and stuff and promoted on our end. So
yeah, please. Any kind of updates you get, send them our way.
For sure, I will definitely keep you guys posted. Thank you. Thank you for offering to do that. And
absolutely.
About the film, yeah.
It's a good one. People need to see it.
Do you think, like, I mean, obviously you're going to stick to this until it's done, but like, do you have any like prospects on what else you might work on next or what you'd like to work on next?
You know, what I've been thinking now is like, it would be really interesting to be in one of these like pop-up hospitals that are dealing with COVID-19, like in New York. Now we have these pop-up hospitals in Central Park, and it's kind of war related in that like those, the medical personnel really are on the front line, so to speak, you know. And what's been interesting to me also is just how, like all the war metaphors we're using with to describe what we're going through now. And part of it, I think, is I'm not sure what to make of it. Like, what do you guys think of that? Like, we're so easy with those, like, we're doing battle with an invisible enemy, which
front
like,
line,
and then
it's buzzwords.
Buzzwords, right? They end up feeling a little shallow, right? Or,
I don't know. I was thinking about that too. But it's, I do like the idea that the language makes it seem like it's a consolidated effort.
That's what I was thinking.
Pretty similar to war in the fact that, you know, the government can't get its shit together enough to get these frontline workers in hospitals and stuff, you know, the proper like protective wear. We couldn't get the gear that we needed when we were downrange. So, I mean, there are lots of parallels. Like,
I heard that story from so many recent veterans.
It sucks, and this sucks, and I don't think they're that different scenarios. I don't know. Tyler's been dealing with it more directly in some cases than I have, because he's a firefighter. But that's the way I see it. I don't think a lot of it's that different. In terms of support and stuff.
I'm a little unfamiliar exactly what y'all are talking about, because, like I said, I have avoided the news very, very well. Like, since all of this has jumped off, my wife has kept me updated, and then I pretty much told her to stop. I don't care anymore. Because
I had to do the same with my wife. I just, like, this is way too much information for this house right now.
Yeah. Like you said, I was somewhat frontline right when it kicked off. My department was. Policies and procedures were moving very proactive, so any type of patient that had answered yes to any type of questions, we were getting fully kitted up and all that, and no contamination immediately, throw the mask on them before we even make patient contact, kind of thing, like literally toss it to them in a way. One of the things that I kind of had an issue with all of that was like, Our most departments and most healthcare facilities are pretty much accepting that patient care is going to suffer a little bit until you can actually do a full screening. And so as somebody who is frontline and wants to help immediately, like a CPR or a heart attack or something like that, obviously they have difficulty breathing, and that's one of the screening questions. And so only one person was allowed to make patient contact during a CPR or a cardiac event when you need more hands than just one
yeah.
set. And so as one person's trying to treat a patient, taking the time to get fully kitted up and all that, like gown, mask, face shield, all this other stuff, that patient is suffering from that. As now your helpers are asking all those screening questions to some bystander possibly, or speaking from a distance, and then they get a yes or something. Now they got to run back and go get all kitted up. And so it was really frustrating because, so I'm at a crossroads because I just had a newborn. So I do have to think of my family, but as somebody who is pretty healthy and I honestly put people before myself, and like as humble or self, however you want to call it, like I just do. So if I have a mask and gloves, I think I'm going to be fine. I'm healthy. And so I wasn't worried about those questions for the longest time, just personally. And I would rather just take care of somebody and then we can kind of do it as we need to. And so I don't know if we were being too precautious and it was just getting overwhelming. Maybe it was the right approach. I'm exactly not sure. Like I said, the numbers are there. I don't know exactly what to make of them. But It was very frustrating for me the last couple shifts before I took off. So I'm off the next month for my baby leave. And it has been great because I'm just home doing projects and hanging out with my kids. So I'm not watching the news. I'm home a lot anyways on my off days. So that's just what it's felt like the past week since she's been born is I'm just working around the house and hanging out with my kids. So I don't mind being quarantined per se.
I think you got a really good excuse there.
It's a pretty, they're pretty good circumstances to be quarantined.
So I was always, I was at a very, I was conflicting constantly because our job requires us to be selfless and that's kind of how I like to think of it. And it's frustrating when you can't, but I had to put my family before it at the same time.
I know that's like a perennial question for me too. Like just like that balance of like, self and community and you know it's like we don't function without the community, but then you even just like having kids sometimes seems like it's definitely like objectively it's a selfish thing, right? It's like but then there's so many ways that it's made me a better person and more engaged and a considerate person. Do you know what I mean? Like having the kids took me out of doing like I volunteered a lot more before I had kids. You know what I mean? I remember, you know? And so, but now I do other things that are like, I'm engaged more in their schools, you know? And it's forced me to talk to people like other parents, you know, who I never would have talked to before, you know, and like, and help them with things. And so I don't know, like, I don't know how to do the math on all that stuff, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I think, you know, initially like having kids can be a selfish thing, but you're right. Like it changes you, right? Like my son asked me today, like, why don't we go to church? And I was like, oh shit. Like, well, I don't know. But you know, we talked about a whole bunch of stuff and, you know, we started talking about like what we believe and what he, you know, he's starting to believe and stuff. And, you know, it came down to like, I told him, like, I believe in being a good person. Like in the end, that's what matters. And he was like, well, what makes you a good person? I'm like, oh, shit. Like, just he was laying it on thick today, but. You know, it's like when your kids are asking those questions, like that's good. Like that's super introspective for, you know, for a 9-year-old to ask, you know, what makes you a good person? I'm not taking responsibility for that. That's, you know, he's his own person. Like he's a cool kid and he, you know, but these times that we're living in, it's important to recognize them for that too, because, you know, I think the kids are feeling it way more than any of us. Like, you know, Aaron, you can probably stay in your apartment or house, like working on, on stuff for quite some time without leaving, like, unless, you know, you need to go to the grocery store or something. But, and I'm the same way, like I'm doing school online. A lot of the stuff I can do right from the house, which, you know, we're fortunate, but like the kids are struggling like socially. You know, so I don't know where I was going with this, but talk to your kid. It's I think this whole thing's been harder on them, but
yeah, I think it's true. They don't have the tools yet to deal with this kind of thing where, you know, your whole life is on a screen. I mean, in a way they do have the tools, but I don't think it's so healthy.
No.
Yeah. I think they probably just like human interaction a lot more than any of us do. So,
yeah.
You know,
or it's a science fiction movie and they're just trying to off all and stop bothering them about being on the
I like that theory.
Well, I wanted to ask you one more question, just because, you know, we have a lot of people who are, you know, transitioning out of the military that follow us, or, you know, a little bit further out, but still trying to plan for that transition, or maybe trying to do a career change. And like, what if someone wanted to get into your industry, you know, like in your role, like what recommendations would you have? For people that want to direct, you know, particularly documentaries, but want to be filmmakers.
Right. Well, I would say that the equipment now is pretty accessible. You can usually find a way to get a camera and some way to edit it. So if you had a story to tell, I would just start doing it, like, and start, you know, gaining that experience. After I went to college, I did do like a certificate program at the New School here in New York, where I had access to that. At the time, it was actually film equipment. So, but it was a cheap way to get access to like expensive equipment. Yeah. And I also met like my cinematography instructor, for example. He helped me shoot, you know, one of my films for really very reduced rate, you know? So like one piece of advice I would give, aside from don't do it, is like to, if there's a program, you know, that can, you know, be helpful in terms of like a little network. But even more important than that is just actually making a film and like learning how to shoot the camera, record sound, tell a story, even if like you want to be, yeah, just learn everything from soup to nuts, like how to start the film, thinking about it, finding a character, finding an interesting story, finding a story you think will be viable, like, because you have to, no matter what, how much of an artiste you think you are, like, you really do have to think of like the commercial marketplace, like, is anyone going to be interested in this film, you know, and why would anyone want to watch this, you know? So I would say, like, do a project, and even if you want to be like, you want to record sound, like, still, like, handle a camera and do all the other pieces of it. And then, like, if you know, I guess, like, choosing where a place where there's work also is a good, you know, especially with film and television. So if you wanted to go into film and television, at least before the coronavirus pandemic, like New York, there's a lot of work here, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
It is not here now, but because everything is just kind of stopped.
So is location like, that important, going to like New York or Los Angeles, or going into like the universities and kind of networking within that, or like the associations of filmmakers? I don't know if there is, like, is it important to get in those kind of in crowds, or is it possible to just completely go independent and just say, come out and say, hey, here's, I have this kind of thing?
I mean, that's really hard unless you have like a celebrity backer.
Yeah.
Which, if you know of any that want to help get my film out there, please let me know.
I know a guy who made a movie about Tim O'Brien. I don't know if that counts.
That guy is not a celebrity or an influencer.
Then no.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think the location does kind of matter, just because like it's so hard to just make a film these days and then just say, hey, look at this. A friend of mine was, because I was really reluctant to do social media, because I just haven't, like, I'm, like you said, I'm older than you guys, and I kind of resisted doing a lot of it. But he said, you know, Marvel doesn't make a movie and hope audiences discover their precious little of a project. They promote the shit out of it, you know? And you have to do the same thing for your movie. So if you want people to, especially these days, it's just that's how the game is played now. And with people starting out, I would say that, like, meet a lot of people, do your networking, and then if you want to just get on the ground experience, you know, moving to a place where there's a lot of work, or like a big, like you could also, like, I lived in central Pennsylvania for a while because my wife was teaching at Penn State, and there were jobs at Penn State connected to, you know, film and TV with local TV station there. So you could do it in smaller markets. You just have to make sure that the work is there, you know? I would just say mostly tell the story you want to tell and get hands-on experience, you know? Do you have ideas? Do you want
to? Do I have ideas?
Yeah.
No.
It seems like that's where you were going.
I think, like, Tyler and I both have, like, nice cameras that we'll dabble with, but it is, I know that if I go down that rabbit hole, that I am just going to end up with another unfinished project, so I'm going to stick to what I got, man. Don't tempt me.
I'm similar to Keith. I wish I was more like you. Like you said, you just focus on one thing. I don't have that ability right now.
We started 100 things.
We have more ideas than we know what to do with, but I've always been interested in film. I've just never actually done it. I've always just really enjoyed documentaries. I've always liked hearing people tell stories. I've always really just personally enjoyed them. And so then my buddy who made one in the fire department, he and I had a couple ideas with some things. That's all they ever are. It's just talking shop. He's busy, I'm busy, but
that's like 95% of what I do. Like, just sitting around, bullshitting with friends, talking about the movie. The idea is so much more fun than trying to actually make it,
I'm like, dude, that's a great idea.
Maybe it is so damn hard.
Great.
Yeah.
You should keep it down in case your wife's listening. Oh, man. Yeah, no, I think that there probably are, you know, we try to attract the creatives, you know, in terms of like the veteran population. We have a lot of people that follow us that aren't veterans either. And so I think it will be reassuring, like, to hear, you know, a little bit of guidance on something like that for people that, you know, like, you know, maybe some guy's getting out and he really enjoyed that Vietnam series that Ken Burns did, and that inspired him, but they don't really know where to go in terms of, you know, education or gear or anything like that. So every little bit of advice helps. And you know, if they hear that somebody just decided to do it and, you know, they're doing it now and they worked with, you know, some big names and made some cool movies already, then, you know, that's inspiring. So
there are production companies to work for, and you know, and I think there's that also that unfortunately now even more than like when I was a kid or when you were kids, like the it's not what you know but who you know, like that it is really important to network with which is like not in my not my best skill, like just like devoting time to kind of, you know, reaching out to people and letting them know you exist. And I think that's you know, something we whatever your career path is, you kind of need to know people.
Absolutely.
For sure. Well, I'm glad we've extended our network here and done you know, good, you didn't even segue. Have to do anything. You just had to answer an email.
and blab for an hour. I don't know who is going to listen to this, boy.
We'll have a couple.
Don't worry.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I should have apologized at the beginning.
No, not at all. We really appreciate it. Is there anything that you want to let anybody know before we let you go?
Man, check out The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien. You know, it's got a lot in there, I think, that if you're a Tim O'Brien fan, you'll appreciate, but also if you're just a human on the planet, you know, struggling. And I think that's what you see with him. You see someone who's like, he's someone who's in struggle, but simultaneously like teaching us how to struggle, you know, because we're all struggling in our own way. Everyone's got their own personal, you know, battle. Sorry for the war metaphor, you know. I think what I learned from Tim is that like it's how you struggle that's important, you know. And he's basically like he's such a decent, kind person, and that was, you know, also, I don't know, refreshing is like a bad word, but it
surprising.
Yeah, so
well, he's super authentic too.
He's like a real person, and made me made me feel good about, you know, people.
Yeah,
that's a good
someone
thing.
who's struggling, but also like very, you know, very kind and a decent person. It's hard to make a story about a decent person, just a decent person. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he's got so much going on that I think a lot of people will connect to him and his family.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome.
Sweet. Is there a way that people can find you?
Yeah. AaronMatthews.com is my website. And then the film is TimO'BrienFilm.com. So that's probably the better way to connect.
Sweet. Perfect.
Yeah. And I got a Twitter now and an Instagram. I just learned what those things are. My kids are teaching me what they are. That's my daughter, like, who's laughing at me right now.
She should be. That's good. Yeah.
But yeah, like Instagram, I would never, we hooked up through Instagram. So it's already born.
Yes.
Through, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we'll tag your Instagram, in the posts and stuff. And then we'll link your website and the documentary website, in the podcast notes for anybody who wants to check that out.
Cool.
And then like we said before, we'll try to keep posting whatever updates you have on the impending release of the film whenever everything gets sorted out and we can actually go back to, you know, standing closer than 6 feet apart from other human beings.
And I'm going to post, I'll be posting clips and like behind the scenes stuff in the film. And so I'll keep you guys in the loop on that.
Awesome.
It's been a pleasure talking with you guys. And
yeah, you as well. Thank you so much for coming on here.
Of course, man. Best of luck with Dead Reckoning too.
I think the biggest misperception is that somehow we're damning. That nothing really can stop us.